Welcome to the GenCast Network. Created every Thursday, GenCasts feature the latest biotech news of the week, plus compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. In this week's GenCast, Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling talks with Dr. Lee Lind from Dartmouth College about bioethanol and biofuel.
Dr. Lee Lind is a professor of engineering and an adjunct professor of biological sciences at Dartmouth College. He heads an interdisciplinary team that is trying to help transition to a world supported by sustainable resources, with a particular focus on plant biomass and bioethanol. He is currently co-leader of a multi-institution project entitled The Role of Biomass in America's Energy Future. Dr. Lind, what are some of the advantages of bioethanol as an alternative to fossil-based liquid fuels?
Well, a big one is that we can think about producing bioethanol from indigenous resources, that is, plant matter we grow here in the United States. Former CIA Director James Woolsey and Richard Lugar wrote an article called The New Petroleum not too long ago. The first sentence was, oil is a magnet for conflict, which is increasingly confirmed by our experience, and they spoke of biomass energy having the potential to democratize the world's energy sources. So the indigenous production, we make it here, along with all of the economic benefits that come with that to the farm community and others. For employment is one set of advantages. Another set of advantages, we're talking about a form of solar energy, so it's renewable and potentially sustainable, and this has particularly got the attention of those who are concerned with global climate change, because it is possible to have a very nearly zero net carbon or net carbon emissions production and utilization cycle of biomass and biofuels. And then the final is the potential for lower cost. If you look at the price of oil, if you look at the price of biomass, the projected price of what farmers would need to be paid to produce switchgrass, for example, you know, it's in the, let's say, $50 per metric ton area. That's about $3 per gigajoule, which I realize isn't that familiar a unit, but the problem is we got to put these different energy sources, barrels, tons, bushels, cubic feet, et cetera, on a common set of units. And if you put oil on the same set of units, $50 a dry ton for cellulosic biomass is equivalent to oil. I'll do it this way. It's $3 a gigajoule for cellulosic biomass. It's over 10 for oil today. So oil is 3 to 4-fold more expensive on a purchased energy basis than cellulosic biomass. And over time, I think it's reasonable to anticipate that the conversion processes for cellulosic biomass will come down in price sufficiently that that we can talk about producing fuels for considerably less than we pay today.
Now, with those advantages, can you provide a sort of a brief status report on the current state of grain-based and biomass ethanol technology?
You bet. I can try. Grain-based ethanol is almost all corn in this country, and I believe we're close to 4 billion gallons of capacity, and that's slated to double under the renewable fuel standard to 7.5 billion gallons by 2012. Grain-based ethanol production is very profitable right now, and there are a tremendous number of plants going in. Most of these plants, all of the new plants, use dry milling technology as opposed to the big integrated wet mills that also produce sweetener, for example. And a very significant fraction of those plants are actually owned by farmer co-ops, which allows farmers to participate in multiple links of the value chain as opposed to only being the first link in the chain and with the feedstock production. On the cellulosic, or sometimes called biomass ethanol technology, it's a very different picture. There are today no money-making cellulosic ethanol plants in the world. There are some demonstration plants, and in fact, some of those may become money-making, I'm told. But right now, it's very much early days as far as the commercial application of this technology. There are many studies anticipating what it will cost at various times in the future to produce cellulosic ethanol. And based on those economics, but many other features, including, as I mentioned, sustainable carbon cycles and benefits to soil fertility. It is generally anticipated that considerably larger amounts of fuel can potentially and eventually be produced from cellulosic biomass as compared to corn, but corn is the game we have established now, and cellulosic biomass is something that people, ethanol from cellulosic biomass, is something that people are optimistic about with respect to the future.
Now, actually, during a recent speech, President Clinton said America needs to move to a biofuel future based more on what he called cellulistic fuels than corn. And now you just gave an advantage long-term, you think, of this type of fuel. Are there any other advantages?
Well, let's see. I mean, corn ethanol is very effective at displacing petroleum use, which is certainly an objective these days. It is somewhat effective at displacing fossil fuel use as practiced currently. It could be more effective at that if natural gas and coal weren't the fuels used for process energy. Ethanol from cellulosic biomass is very positive with respect to both of the metrics I just mentioned. That is, both greenhouse gas emission reductions and reduced petroleum utilization on a life cycle basis. In addition, we can anticipate getting somewhat more fuel per unit land, although not dramatically so, for cellulosic ethanol as compared to corn. In addition, the price of cellulose on a pure per energy basis is somewhat less, about a factor of two less than the price of corn kernels at current prices. And in addition, when an environmentalist looks at planting many new acres in corn versus many new acres in a perennial grass, for example, they get a lot more excited about the soil fertility implications of expanded acreage under perennial grasses than they do expanded acreage under corn. Now, that's not to say that corn grown in appropriate sites can't be sustainable and beneficial, but you can grow grass in a lot more sites and have it be sustainable and environmentally beneficial.
Now there's a whole new emerging field of biotechnology called industrial biotech. In fact, my publisher decided to put out a journal about a year and a half ago on this.
Yeah.
And a large part of it is covered on alternative fuels and bioethanol. We're curious to know what types of biotechnologies are critical to bioethanol R&D and production versus, say, some old line, chemical technologies?
Well, I would say you've got a large suite of biotechnologies that are relevant to cellulosic ethanol and are also relevant to many, many other applications. And so, you know, I'm talking about all of the new tools of systems biology are actually relevant at two different levels when it comes to cellulosic biomass. Once in terms of what happens in the field and figuring out how to make more productive crops, and then second, in terms of the engineered microorganisms that will be used for the conversion processes. So in both of these instances, the tools of systems biology are very, very well represented in terms of the frontiers for cellulosic ethanol. And some more, some better established techniques, of course, are also biotechnology techniques that are, I would say, generic, are also important both to cellulosic ethanol as well as to, most other products you'd produce biotechnologically. Then there are a set of biotechnologies that are rather specific to cellulosic ethanol and are to varying degrees, but are not so general. In particular, the matter of microbial cellulose utilization and its fundamentals and how to beneficially exploit it and manage it, if you will, and design organisms for it, this is something which is really quite specific and quite important, actually, for cellulosic ethanol. In addition, biotechnologies related to system-level properties as opposed to individual gene properties, which is a somewhat more challenging set of applications. Just to give you an example, product tolerance, you know, solvent tolerance, ethanol tolerance, is not determined by a single gene. And this type of how to engineer and improve this type of property at a system level when it's a multigenetic determined by multiple genes is a challenge. There are some specific problems related to using different kinds of soluble sugars. And then the final thing is that at least a significant fraction of the microorganisms that we would like to use in various capacities to produce ethanol and perhaps enzymes pursuant to producing ethanol from cellulose have tools which are not so well developed. I mean, we're not talking about E. coli or Pichia or something like that here for which the tools are voluminous. I mean, just for example, a particular microorganism, Clostridium thermacellum, that really grows fast on cellulose, until very, very recently, there was no gene transfer system for it at all. So that would bring you back to sometime in the 70s in terms of the state of E. coli molecular biology. So there is a need to also do some things that are basic in other fields and just to let this field catch up for some of the particular host organisms that are interesting. So there probably are some others, but in general, the take-home message is most of the techniques that are sort of expanding the rest of biotechnology can also be applied to cellulosic biomass and conversion to ethanol. And then there are a few specific biotechnological issues that are quite important to this field.
Now, if you look at this field on a global basis, which countries have taken the lead in bioethanol production and practical utilization, and why have they been successful?
Well, when people say bioethanol, it's often not clear whether they would encompass, for example, corn or sugarcane ethanol or perhaps limiting to cellulosic. So let me answer it for both. I mean, Brazil is a big leader. They produce 50% of their transportation fuel from sugarcane in the form of ethanol, and which is the largest fractional contribution by far in the world. To contrast that, we are on the order of 3% in this country. So Brazil is certainly a leader on sugarcane, and that likely will be replicated in some other climatically suitable countries around the world in the next few years under the current circumstances. But a lot of places in the world can't grow sugarcane. The U.S. is a significant leader, probably the most active country in the world when it comes to cellulosic ethanol, although certainly not the only one. Sweden and a number of countries in the EU, but probably most notably Sweden, have substantial efforts. There's some great work going on in the Netherlands, for example. Most countries in France, U.K., Germany, really most countries have something going on in this space. But I would say that in cellulosic ethanol research or cellulosic ethanol biotechnology across the board, I think it's fair to say that the U.S. is certainly a leader, and many would say the leader. So I think those are the thoughts that come to mind on that question.
Okay. And so my final question is, even though, say, we're a leader technologically and beginning to move this out into the market, I think a lot of people, especially in light of the recent gas prices and fuel shortages around the world, some people, I think, still get the feeling that we're not getting there as quick as we should be. In other words, a more rapid transition to a biofuel-based economy, especially in this country. Is that a true perception? And if so, what do we need to do to get there quicker?
Well, that's an interesting question and a relevant one. In general, government investment, and it's not necessarily only the government that's going to, in fact, it won't be only the government that's going to move this forward, and that's a recent change. There's much greater impact, interest in the private sector and the venture community. But to start with government, government invests, this was true at least a couple of years ago, and I doubt it's changed, invests less money in R&D now than we did in 1973 in the United States, which, you know, really doesn't make much sense when you consider the challenges we're facing. And actually, at that point anyway, when that article was written in Science, I'm referring to work that John Holdren described, industrial investment in energy R&D had been declining steadily since the early 80s as well. Now, we now have a very different environment, and some of those trends may be reversing. Indeed, the current Energy Policy Act is actually, in my opinion, quite a good blueprint for accelerating this area. And so we've got it's not that we haven't that we need to necessarily do new legislation, although in some instances we could, and I'll get to those in a minute. But the Energy Policy Act of 2005 is a very, very good start. The key thing is that at this point we have authorized the expenditures of monies and how they're going to be expended. We, meaning the Congress, has authorized the expenditures and how they're going to be expended, but they have not yet appropriated. Now, that's not finding fault, because the appropriation cycle is going on now and won't be completed until September or so. But the point is, in the past, there's often been a significant gap between what's been authorized and what's appropriated. And so one key thing is we need to actually appropriate consistent with the Energy Policy Act or some similarly aggressive timetable, which that would be significantly more aggressive than the past has been. And so that's one comment. We need balanced investment in technology deployment and innovation-focused R&D. And that deployment and innovation-focused R&D in the broader scheme of things, that investment can come not only from the government, but also can and will come in significant part from the private sector. It is particularly important, of course, that we invest in what's important, and in cellulosic biomass, that means focusing on conversion of this largely recalcitrant raw material that we get from nature in the form of wood chips or agricultural residues or what have you, and converting these to reactive intermediates. In the case of biotechnology, that would most likely be to sugars. That conversion step, notwithstanding recent advances that have been made, is still the most costly and the place where advanced technology can make the biggest difference. We need to, getting away from the technology or the conversion technology, also, by the way, there's several issues related to feedstock production, which I think we need to take a more, and this probably will be to a significant part public sector work, although again augmented by the private sector. So when it comes to growing cellulosic crops that are well suited to high productivity agriculture and to rewarding the farmer in various ways, there's significant scope there on the R&D front. We need to avoid infrastructure bottlenecks. For example, one of the nice things about ethanol is that it can be blended at low levels and mixed with gasoline, and all U.S. cars sold in the last 20 years are guaranteed for those blends. But if we're going to go to higher ethanol and avoid, you know, sort of putting a ceiling on the contribution ethanol could make, we're going to need vehicles that can use higher blends than 10% ethanol, for example, E85, and we need to make sure that the vehicle fleets are there, and to a lesser extent, but it's not probably as big of a challenge, that the distribution system is there. And finally, frankly, we need to proceed in a way that engages rather than confronts powerful constituencies. I think, for example, that the farm interest can be very much aligned and served. I think that aggressive effort to go to cellulosic ethanol, I think that the environmental interest can also be well aligned and well served. And for that matter, I don't despair in the least that the current energy industries, the petroleum companies, I think their interests, they also can be aligned and involved and their interests well served. But so while I'm optimistic that it can be done in ways that really engage these constituencies, all of whom have, you know, represent various aspects of the public interest in this, I'm equally sure that we can do this if we mess it up. I think we can do this in ways that don't serve the interests of one or more of these important constituencies. So we just need to pay attention to this, and I'm not saying accommodate every desire of each constituent, blindly, but I think that most of these desires can be, and especially their core desires, can be met if we pay attention. And that's going to have a big effect, whether we do that or not, on how fast and how effectively all of this unfolds.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, be sure to visit our website at www.genengnews.com. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus, saying thanks for joining us, and be sure to tune in next Thursday.